The government, in yet another attempt to look like they're on top of the green agenda, has just brought forward its ban on all diesel, petrol, and hybrid cars to 2035. From that date, you'll only be allowed to buy electric or hydrogen vehicles. Our wise central planners reckon those gas-guzzling, polluting SUVs we all like so much will be banished from the road, and all those petrol stations replaced with sleek new charging stations. But the state has a terrible record of telling us what to drive. It's only a few years since it used tax policy to get us all to buy diesels, and no one needs to be reminded how that worked out. It was later discredited and severely damaged the market for second-hand diesels. The subsidies fueled a rise in diesel cars, which increased air pollution. How we get around is changing at lightning speed. But would it be better to let consumers shape that future instead of the state trying to dictate it? Joining me, Darren Grimes, to discuss is the IEA's Dr. Richard Wellens, Head of Transport at the IEA. Hello, Richard.
Hello, Darren.
Richard, what's the problem here? There's nothing wrong, surely, with moving wholesale to electric or hydrogen-powered vehicles. In fact, surely it's the opposite. They're cleaner, they're potentially more efficient, and are undoubtedly the direction of travel, if you'll excuse the pun.
Well, I mean, we know what happens from bitter experience when the government tries to plan the economy centrally, tries to pick winners, tries to ban things. The results are often disastrous, and I fear the costs of this process are going to be absolutely immense for both consumers and taxpayers.
Mm-hmm. What are you thinking, ballpark? Have you any idea? Can you even begin to estimate the cost of this?
Well, I think it's definitely going to run into the hundreds of billions of pounds. I mean, we've got the need for extra capacity in the power generation supply, so probably a few new power stations too. Remember, this is also happening at the time when the government's also going to try and ban gas central heating as well. So, I mean, the costs there are going to be astronomical. So just Hinkley Point C, just one power station, one nuclear power station, is estimated to cost around $22
billion. Wow.
We might need four, five, six of those to deal with the extra demand from electric vehicles. And then there's obviously a lot of the local electricity grids going to be upgraded. Also, the extra cost of electric vehicles compared with their conventional equivalents. At the moment, they're hugely expensive. Mm. So there are all kinds of problems here.
I mean, exactly. And to do this all in the time frame set out, which is the same amount of time that it takes a child to go through school, surely that's a pretty tall order. And the implications of phasing out petrol and diesel must be absolutely enormous.
That's right. And the danger is by setting this date in stone that it's going to put a lot of pressure on real resources. So, you know, where are all the electricians going to come from? It's going to put upward pressure on costs, whereas if you let this happen in a more organic piecemeal process, I mean, I think the cost will be a lot lower if they're spread over a longer period. It happened more naturally, for example, with the new sockets in houses being fitted to new houses, but not necessarily to the existing housing stock. I mean, how on earth are they going to manage in all the terrace streets where people don't have anywhere to park their cars? It's going to be an absolute nightmare to put in all that stuff.
So isn't this, I mean, the government are right to argue, aren't they, that this is a sensible way to incentivize industry to create the carbon neutral solutions that we actually need?
Well, it may not be the most cost effective way to cut carbon emissions. And of course, there are huge unknown unknowns as to what's going to happen in terms of climate change. So the idea that we can set these targets optimally is cloud cuckoo land, I'm afraid. But nonetheless, if you were going to try and address this in a more economically efficient way, you'd probably do something like have a carbon tax that was applied equally across all sectors of the economy rather than trying to pick winners in certain sectors, which unfortunately has happened not just in transport, but also in energy. It's a huge cost to consumers.
Mm-hmm. Because it is true that if you look at air pollution, an estimated 40,000 premature deaths a year in the UK alone are linked to health problems that stem from child illnesses to heart disease. So it is, you know, no one doesn't want cleaner air, do they?
I mean, that is potentially a big benefit from electric vehicles, not only the urban air pollution, but also the reduction in noise as well, which is a big problem in many cities. But against that, though, obviously a lot of the particulates don't actually come from the exhaust. They come from the brakes and the tyres, which is going to be the same with electric cars, or possibly even worse, because they often can be heavier. Also, I mean, a lot of the science is pretty dubious on this local air pollution. So the problem is, clearly, the kind of people that live in heavily polluted inner city areas are not the same kind of people that live in posher rural areas, and to try and take that out of the health outcomes is quite difficult in the modelling, so we've got to be cautious there.
What are some market-friendly solutions then for how the... because, for example, you wouldn't be able to receive... the Treasury wouldn't be able to receive the fuel duty anymore, which is a massive amount of money. I mean, how are you going to go about replacing that funding gap? The government, some ideas are include things like increasing the road fund license to £1,000 or more for each car to make up the shortfall, or taxing the electricity itself. But that sounds like a big burden for the lowest paid, doesn't it? I mean, what are some of the solutions that you reckon could fill that gap?
Well, I mean, the good news from the government's perspective is that the fuel duty revenues have been flatlining, as partly because of the freeze, but partly because conventional engines have been getting a lot more efficient and using less fuel per mile. So that's good news. But I mean, clearly, in terms of climate change more generally, there are a lot of win-win policies that would actually benefit the economy and potentially benefit the environment. Things like reducing the fuel subsidies that are commonplace in many countries across the world, improve property rights in a lot of developing countries, so you don't get, you know, the president's brother's firm destroying the rainforest, or these daft EU palm oil biofuels policies that encourage people to, you know, destroy the rainforest and so on. So I think really that's the first thing to get done, these win-win policies that benefit both the economy and the environment.
That's my concern, right? My concern is that in a dash to do something about climate change in the past, we've burnt these so-called renewable wood pellets for biofuel. We've encouraged people to buy diesel cars. We've encouraged people to buy hybrid cars. And now we're turning around to people and saying, actually, we got that wrong. We incentivized you incorrectly, and now your car is going to be next to worthless on the second-hand market.
That's right, and of course it's causing real problems for the car industry now, because people just don't know what's going to come next. Is the government going to suddenly change course again, as they did with diesel? So people are just not buying cars because of the uncertainty. So it's really difficult. So, you know, I think really it would have made more sense to delay this a bit, at least, to just to give the industry a bit of a break from all this.
So then do you reckon people are going to start losing their jobs then, if the car industry in this country just doesn't know its bum from its elbow, basically?
I mean, clearly they really don't need this, because they're also facing pressures from, obviously, much cheaper production in developing countries such as China, and probably in the future India. So, you know, it's going to be a hugely difficult period for the car industry anyway.
Mm. The combined taxes that are already raised from motoring are around 45 billion quid. Yet only about 10 billion of that is spent on new roads and maintenance. Do you foresee a future where we're going to get these new taxes that aren't actually for combating climate change or building electric infrastructure at all?
Well, I mean, yeah, this is a bit of a headache for the government. And of course, the problem with the road network is that supply has been pretty much completely divorced from demand. You haven't had the normal market mechanism. So if you've got a congested road, then there's an financial incentive to build new capacity. So the obvious solution would be some form of road pricing. But I do worry that under the current political climate, this would be used effectively as yet another tax on motorists. It would be used to fulfill environmentalists' agenda, rather than actually being used to benefit the economy and motorists. And the danger then is that it has a knock-on effect on productivity, for example, by basically pricing the poor off the roads, reducing their labour mobility, meaning they can't get better jobs because it's too hard for them to travel to those better jobs and so on. Also, obviously, higher taxes on transport are also effectively a tax on internal trade in the UK as well. And you could get destroyed economies of scale and so on. So potentially this could be really, really bad. And we could see it being another factor in stagnating living standards for ordinary people looking over the next couple of decades.
Well, I want to touch on that a bit then, because, you know, we don't bother with the sorry business of politics here at the IEA. But surely, Richard, the poorer people in society who are likely to lose their cars, likely to lose... be hit as far as things like their heating bills are concerned, you know, ripping out your gas central heating, for example, and then being attacked on your petrol and diesel cars. Surely there's going to be a sort of gilet jaune, as we've seen in France, style movement against this sort of thing, isn't there? Is that a risk, do you think?
Well, I don't think we'll like to see the kind of protests we've seen in France in this country, just because street protests aren't the same tradition in the UK. Obviously, you know, street violence is very commonplace in France over the years, and even going back to the revolution, it's, you know, part of their political culture. But nonetheless, it could lead to a lot of cynicism in politics. So the fact that this is very much a top-down policy imposed by elites on ordinary people who maybe would have different priorities, that could be a huge problem for politicians going forward.
Mm-hmm. Now, you touched on it a little bit about different ways in which you could, the Treasury could raise revenue, etc. But, I mean, going back to 1964, as far back as that, charging motorists for how many miles they drive was advocated in the Smead Committee, by the Smead Committee rather, but it wasn't actually taken up. Do you think that should have been taken up? Is that a fairer way of going about things?
I think if the roads could be privately owned, it would make sense. But I do think there's a danger that with government-owned roads, then roads, the policy could be used to promote a particular agenda and to price people off the roads. Mm-hmm. So it wouldn't be about trying to reduce congestion efficiently. It would be, for example, to redistribute resources, as we saw with the London congestion charge, mm-hmm. where the money didn't go back to those motorists who were being charged. It was used to cross-subsidise public transport. And the other problem is the admin costs from charging as well. So the admin costs for the congestion charge are very high. So it's just this waste of resources when you get these very complicated schemes. And obviously, some of the special interests, the firms that would operate these schemes, have a vested interest in making them complex and expensive, because that will tend to increase their profits through the administration process. Mm-hmm. So I think it's definitely a case to introduce it at some of the really bad bottlenecks on the road network, though. The case is very clear there.
Yeah. Well, speaking of those bottlenecks, are we not on hiding for nothing if we think about, and well, I fear I'm about to be guilty of trying to predict the future a lot like our politicians are trying to do. But if you think about things like every tech company now is working on driverless vehicles, and once they arrive, surely we're more likely to be pods that move around cities 24/7 rather than a VW Golf with a robot at the wheel. And the important point there is that the car as we know it might not actually exist in a decade anyway.
Well, I mean, this shows the problem of trying to pick winners and centrally plan the economy, you know, 15, 20, 25 years ahead. So there can be these disruptive innovations that are complete game changers. I'm a bit sceptical, though, that these driverless cars initially, especially the ones that are hired out, that they will be popular outside the inner city areas. If you think about rural locations, people still have to wait a while for the pod to arrive, and there would be additional costs and inconvenience from that. So I think it might be a far more mixed picture than we possibly think at the moment.
Mm. Yeah, that's a good point, actually. So then, Richard, I wonder if to end, you can tell me if you're called up by the Department for Transport, we're still waiting for the call, and they say to you, come on, Richard, I want the greenest possible transport policy as far as Britain's cars and our roads are concerned, what would you tell them?
Well, I think really that's the wrong approach entirely, because focusing entirely on the environmental benefits neglects the trade-offs with the economy. So the problem is, I mean, you could have, you know, spend a fortune on green policies, but that would come at the expense of the economy, which would have a devastating effect on people's living standards. And of course, we can think about other aspects of the environment, such as people's living conditions, that would be negatively affected if these wider green policies went too far and, you know, pushed up people's heating bills and their transport costs. So there has to be an awareness of the huge trade-offs here. That's really important.
Well, do you think politicians are being honest about the trade-offs?
Well, I think they need to come clean on the costs of all this, and they haven't been very clear at all. So they're making these very grandiose policy announcements, but they haven't come clean about the full cost of this. And we are talking here, just with the shift to electric cars, we're talking about hundreds of billions of pounds here. So it's basically makes HS2 look like small change. It's, you know, huge amounts of money.
Well, exactly, and that's exactly right. But then when you start to look at it as a wider policy prescription, you've got moves against flights, you've got moves against meat, you've got moves against now with the cars that we're seeing, you've got moves against central heating. You know, there are so many areas that are now starting to be touched in pursuit of being greener. But actually, we're seeing that government often gets it wrong more than it gets it right. So are we not at risk of being on a total, well, a very expensive and almost bankrupting hiding to nothing?
Well, I think developed countries can probably cope with these costs, but what really worries me is the impact on poor countries. This could seriously hinder their development. And, you know, when people are dying through the lack of basic facilities, this could be disastrous. If they're not allowed to develop through using cheap energy sources, it could really hinder their economic growth, and that will cost huge numbers of lives. So there's a real balancing act that needs to be done here. There needs to be an awareness of these very, very important trade-offs here.
Well, thank you very much, Richard. You've provided much food for thought. And you can let us know at home what you think by tweeting at IEA London. And you can subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Podbean.